Good evening. We told you we were going to go to the beach, and I know some of you might be looking at me thinking, did they really go to the beach? Because if possible, Todd came back even lighter than when he went. But I told my wife, I have no shame in using children's sunscreen. I absolutely hate getting sunburned. It's just irritates me. I can't stop thinking about it. It's awful. I don't like getting sunburned. So me and Gavin, we devoured a bottle of 50 SPF this past week, and reapplied frequently. You know, it was not quite like the Weather Channel on the 8s, but close enough. Just trying to really make sure that we stayed nice and coated throughout. So in everybody's life, there's kind of these defining moments, not particularly like in your own personal life, but there's moments in time that you live through. For me, one of the moments in time that was just a moment that you kind of remember where you were and what was going on were the shootings at Columbine High School in Littleton, Colorado. I was a freshman in high school myself at the time, so I just remember all the hysteria. I remember the kind of lockdown policy that went into effect and how there was only one approved entrance and exit from the school from that point. And things began to be taken very seriously if people got upset or angry, and because nobody wanted to see that tragedy happen again. Two young boys went into their high school armed, killed several of their classmates before eventually taking their own lives. And a lot of things always come out right after those sorts of instances. You hear acts of heroism, you hear acts of fear, you hear people saying, I can't believe this happened. These were good boys. I'm amazed that they would do such a thing. And then as time goes on, as was the case with the gentleman in Littleton, Colorado, you begin to look deeper and you see that maybe there were signs. Maybe there were signs that not everything was okay. Maybe there were signs that they were leading up towards something even worse. In situations like that, you look for vandalism, you look for killing animals, blowing up mailboxes, those types of things that are signs that lead you to think that maybe these people could go further. Not just harm property, not just harm animals, but harm people. And they determined these things, they saw these things, and eventually they said, we should have said something, we should have looked deeper. And every time there's a school shooting, every time there's something in that situation, and even now when they're averted, people begin looking for those things because there are signs. These tragic events rarely happen out of the blue, but they are kind of the pinnacle, the brightest spot that you see out of a whole line of succession of events that were pointing that direction. And sin and godlessness is the same way. And that's what the passage that we're going to look at tonight in Judges chapter 17 and 18 tell us. There's a saying that says the road to hell is paved with good intentions. I don't know how true that is, but to steal from that, I want to say tonight that as we read through this, what we're going to find is that the road to godlessness is paved with godlessness. That what we're going to see is that when these horrendous, atrocious acts against God happen, they were usually brought on and precipitated by other acts against God that should have been seen and should have been caught and should have been corrected. So what we're going to do, I'm going to kind of lead you through a quick summary of Judges 17 and 18. We're not going to read all of this, but essentially there's kind of three main movements to this one big story that happens in these two chapters. They involve a man named Micah, who should not be confused with the prophet Micah, a Levite, who is a member of the priestly tribe of Israel, and then the entire tribe of Dan, one of the 12 tribes of Israel. So we'll begin, and I'll read, and then I'll begin just summarizing some of the things that are going on. There was a man of the hill country of Ephraim. His name was Micah, and he said to his mother, the 1,100 pieces of silver that were taken from you, about which you uttered a curse and also spoke it in my ears, behold, the silver is with me. I took it. And his mother said, "Blessed be my son by the Lord." And then from here, what happens is he gives her back the 1,100 pieces, and then she takes the 1,100 pieces of silver, takes out 200 of them, sends them to a silversmith. It's about 5 pounds of silver. Takes them to a silversmith and has a metal image made out of them, an idol. And the idol was in the house of Micah. And the man Micah had a shrine, and he made an ephod and household gods and ordained one of his sons who became his priest. So we have this weird situation where Micah stole money from his mother. She utters a curse, not like a curse word, but basically says, you know, something like, I beg God to strike down whoever stole this money from me. He feels guilty, convicted, tells her. For some odd reason, then this escalates into her blessing him and then turning part of that money into an idol. And then Micah, just kind of seemingly out of the blue, builds a shrine and gets an ephod, which we saw Gideon do, which is not a good thing. And he had household gods and even ordained one of his own sons to be a priest of this little religion he built in his own house. That's movement one. That's Micah. Let me get the Levite. It says, "Now there was a young man of Bethlehem in Judah, of the family of Judah, who was a Levite, and he sojourned there. And the man departed from the town of Bethlehem in Judah to sojourn where he could find a place." And what happens is he's sojourning, which he's traveling around. He's kind of pilgrimaging. He's trying to find a place to settle down. He happens upon Micah. And Micah says, "Well, hey, look at my luck. Here comes a Levite. Those are the priestly tribe of God," just like I said a moment ago. He said, "I bet he would do a better job at being a priest in my little shrine of Micah's house that I have built than my son would, because my son is an Ephraimite. He's not really a priest. He's just kind of playing one on the weekends, right? Well, we've got this priest who came up. Let me see if I can convince him to be a priest, my own kind of personal priest." And they have this kind of transaction going along. And finally, Micah says to him, "Stay with me and be to me a father and a priest," kind of a role model, a figure to look after, and a priest. "And I will give you 10 pieces of silver a year and a suit of clothes and your living." And the Levite went in. And the Levite was content to dwell with the man, and the young man became to him like one of his sons. So what we see is that the Levite, who we'll learn later has a name, his name is Jonathan, the Levite takes up the offer. He says, 10 pieces of silver, a suit of clothing, room and board. All right, I'm in. Sounds good to me. I've been looking for a place to live. This is the best offer I found. Let's do it. We'll see why this offer was so appealing to him later on. And he becomes this man's kind of personal priest. He's got his cult religion of the house of Micah, and now he has his own personal priest, Jonathan. All right. So then from there, the tribe of Dan comes into play. And again, this all wraps up together. In those days, there was no king in Israel, and in those days, the tribe of the people of Dan was seeking for itself an inheritance to dwell in. For until then, no inheritance among the tribes of Israel had fallen to them. So the people of Dan sent 5 able men from the whole number of their tribe, from Zorah and from Eshtaol, to spy out the land and to explore it. That sound familiar? The 12 spies sent out by Moses to see the promised land? Well, it should sound familiar because this almost parallels what happens there, only in a tragic way. The tribe of Dan sends out 5 spies, and they go, and they're trying to find a land because the Danites, they're condensed. They have this small piece of land in Zorah and Eshtaol. Not enough. It's not enough land. They need more space. And so they're going to try and find more space. They send out these 5 spies, and lo and behold, what happens? The 5 spies come to the house of Micah. Why? Well, it says they were passing by, and they heard a voice that they recognized. Apparently, they knew the Levite. He got around. And maybe he sojourned through the Eshtaol or Zorah at some point. We don't know. But they come and they talk with him. And they say, hey, could you kind of do some priestly things for us and inquire with God? Is it going to go well with us? And he says, oh, yeah, it'll be good. And one of the things, if we read this, it says, inquire of God, please, that we may know whether the journey on which we are setting out will succeed. And the priest said to them, go in peace. The journey on which you go is under the eye of the Lord. This is a little weird transaction that happens here. And if you kind of read between the lines in your Bible, it says, inquire of God, that's Elohim, not Yahweh, not the covenant Lord. It's just, hey, inquire of the gods or of a god. Just, you know, kind of see if things are going to go well for us. Ask somebody somewhere. They don't call God by his covenant name. And then the priest, he just gives them kind of this quick, terse, ambiguous response. Go in peace. Say, yeah, have at it. The journey on which you go is under the eye of the Lord. Well, I mean, is that really good, bad? I don't know. He doesn't say, go, the Lord will bless you. And he just says, go, your journey is under the eye of the Lord. But, you know, it was what they wanted. They said, all right, good enough for us. They take off, they go to Laish, they find these people, and it says the people who were there, they lived in security after the manner of the Sidonians, quiet and unsuspecting, lacking nothing that is in the earth and possessing wealth. And how they were far from the Sidonians and had no dealings with anyone. Basically, what's happened here is these spies have come upon a little town that's well-to-do, kind of peaceful, quiet, and doesn't have anybody around to help them. And they say, hey, they look ripe for the picking. Right? These people, if we come in, we could take over this land. There's not the Sidonians. It says they're far from the Sidonians. That means, ain't nobody going to be here to help them. We get the jump on them, take them over. What are they going to do? They can't radio to somebody. Nobody's going to see it happening. They're isolated. They're ready for us to come and just take over the city of Laish. And so they're excited, and they go back to the people. What do you report? They said, arise and let us go up against them. For we have seen the land, and behold, it is very good. And then they go. They can't wait to go. And will you do nothing? Do not be slow to go, to enter in and possess the land. They're excited. They're ready to get it going, right? This is, they've been living in these cramped quarters, not enough room for all the people. They said, here we go. This is the solution. Let's get out there. Let's take care of it. The land is spacious, for God has given it into your hands, a place where there is no lack of anything that is in the earth. And so they go, armed with weapons of war, and they take off, and on their way, they come to the house of Micah, which, of course, they did, because it's part of this whole story. And they passed it before, and when they passed the house of Micah, they say, you know what? We've got these weapons. This is just the house of Micah. He has those images and the gods, and he even has that nice little Levite priest of his. Why don't we take them? So, it says, and they turned aside, and there came to the house of the young Levite at the home of Micah, and asked him about his welfare. Now the 600 men of the Danites, armed with their weapons of war, stood by the entrance of the gate. And the five men who had gone to scout out the land went up and entered and took the carved image, the ephod, and the household gods, and the metal image, while the priest stood by the entrance of the gate with the 600 men armed with weapons of war. So they're just ransacking this whole household religion of Micah. And then he says to him, what are you doing? And they said to him, keep quiet. Put your hand on your mouth and come with us and be to us a father and a priest. Oh, hey, they want him to do the same things he's been doing here with Micah. Is it better for you to be priest to the house of one man or to be priest to a tribe and a clan in Israel? So now they're appealing to his kind of pragmatic side. They're saying, hey, you just got this one house and this one dude here. When he keels over, what are you going to do? You could come and be special priest to the Danites, right? You could be our priest. And the priest's heart was glad. He took the ephod and the household gods and the carved image and went along with the people. And of course, Micah's upset about that. He tries to come, and they're like, dude, we've got 600 armed men with weapons of war. They turn him back. Then they go to Laish, says, and the priest who belonged to him, and they came to Laish, to a people quiet and unsuspecting, and struck them with the edge of the sword and burned the city with fire. and there was no deliverer because it was far from Sidon, and they had no dealings with anyone. So they take the city, they burn it to the ground, they rebuild it, they change its name, right? Because that's what you do in the Bible. Every time they come somewhere, they change its name. Guess what they called it? They called it Dan, which I think it's funny. It says Dan after the name of Dan, their ancestor. That made me laugh. Who was born to Israel, but the name of the city was Laish at first. And the people of Dan set up the carved image for themselves, and Jonathan, this is the Levite, the son of Gershom, son of Moses. So this kind of opportunistic Levite, who's a descendant of Moses, and he's part of the big family, which means he's descended from Aaron. It means he's an important priest. And his sons were priests to the tribe of the Danites until the day of the captivity of the land. So they set up Micah's carved image that he made as long as the house of God was at Shiloh. So essentially what happened was they took over the city, renamed it Dan, set up this cultic religion that they stole from Micah, took descendants, direct descendants of Moses, established them as their own personal priests to these pagan gods, and they did that as long as the house of God was at Shiloh. So that was throughout the time of the judges. So that's our story. Kind of weird. Micah, the Levite, the tribe of Dan. So what's going on here? You kind of have to read between the lines a little bit with some of this, not all of it. But essentially what's going on is you have people who are not doing what they're supposed to be doing, who then only go further in their godlessness. Right? These aren't people who are just going around minding their business, behaving, and then just commit this tragic sin out of nowhere. These were people who developed a pattern of godlessness, and it led to further and greater and deeper godlessness. Let's recount what we're seeing here with Micah. Well, it starts with something he's not supposed to be doing. He's breaking two of the Ten Commandments. That's 1/5. 20% of the commandments he's breaking. That's how we're introduced to Micah. He's failing to honor his mother, and he's stealing. Right? He said to his mother, the 1,100 pieces of silver that were taken from you, about which you uttered a curse, and also spoken in my ears, behold, silver is with me. I took it. Now, he is confessing. Doesn't really sound like repentance. I took it, right? He's not like, please forgive me, I'm sorry I've sinned against you, and my God, or anything of that nature. He's like, hey, Ma, I took it. Sorry about that. He doesn't even really say sorry. He just says, here it is. He's breaking the commandments. He's not honoring his mother. He's stealing. And then that just leads him to further godlessness. He winds up building a pagan cult in his house. It's just ridiculous what happens here. Just the way this escalates out of nowhere, but it's not out of nowhere. He wasn't doing what he was supposed to be doing, and he kept on not doing what he was supposed to be doing. What about the Levite? The Levite's a little harder. What is the Levite doing? We're introduced to the Levite. We're told that he lives in Bethlehem, which, we like Bethlehem. Seems like a good place. Good things happen in Bethlehem a lot in Scripture. He wasn't necessarily supposed to be in Bethlehem. This wasn't really one of the cities that Levites were supposed to go to. Maybe he was there on official business. We don't know. But he probably didn't belong in Bethlehem in the first place. And then it says, and he departed from the town of Bethlehem in Judah to sojourn where he could find a place. Which essentially is, he left Bethlehem because he didn't really like it and he was looking for somewhere else that he liked better. Now, that's not really what Levites are to be doing. Levites were given cities. They weren't given a whole territory. They were distributed throughout the people of Israel to serve as priests for the people of Israel. But they were given certain cities within the Promised Land to be in. Bethlehem was not one of them. But if they were to go outside of those cities they were supposed to be in, here's what it says, and if a Levite comes from any of your towns out of all Israel where he lives, and he may come when he desires to the place that the Lord will choose. So if Levites were to leave one of the cities that was given to them to be in, it was because they were going on official business for the king, right? They're supposed to be going out to the place where the Lord will choose. But here, I think it's deliberate. He was set up where he could find a place. He's just kind of hitchhiking, putting his thumb out, seeing where the road leads him. Right? He's following his own desires. He's wandering aimlessly. We don't read anything about him actually serving in his official capacity as a priest of God anywhere. But he's just kind of milling around, you know, Israel, checking it out, taking in the scenery, going to find the place that he wants to go instead of the place where he's supposed to go. So he's already not doing what he's supposed to be doing. And he just continues to not do what he's supposed to be doing and moves into further godlessness. Because at least we have no indication at this point that he's been a pagan priest. But when he sees the financial benefit that comes from being with Micah, and then the financial and even kind of the status benefit that comes from being with the Danites, he says, sure, why not? I'll be a priest for hire, for whatever gods you put before me. And again, you know, this is not good. And it shows he's taking this opportunity. It's a financial benefit. The money drags him in. What's they offered? 10 shekels of silver a year, a set of clothes, room and board. This was not what was given to the priests. They were basically told, hey, go there, be there, the people provide you food. The 10 shekels of silver? Well, he's going to be living high on the horse. Right? That's a lot better deal than he was ever going to get being a priest of Yahweh. So he takes it. And then what about the tribe of Dan? What's so bad about the tribe of Dan? Well, again, this is another one, and it's easy to miss it, particularly the way that our Bibles have been translated. Our Bible says this. It says, in those days there was no king in Israel, and in those days the tribe of the people of Dan was seeking for itself an inheritance to dwell in. For until then, no inheritance among the tribes of Israel had fallen to them. So it makes it kind of seem like they just weren't given a place to be. They were just said, hey, sorry, Dan, we ran out of space. And they're like, well, give us an inheritance, please. Really what the inheritance here is, when it says we're seeking for itself an inheritance to dwell in, really the word that's being used there is a place that they could conquer. They were looking for a place to take possession of, military. They weren't looking for their inheritance that was guaranteed to them as the people of God. They were looking for a place to conquer. Why were they looking for a place to conquer? Because they had failed to conquer the place they were supposed to conquer in the first place. See, Joshua gave them a very clear place to be. If you go to Joshua 19, Zorah and Eshtaol are part of where they're supposed to be, but there's a whole lot more. But unfortunately, they failed to do that. They failed to take possession of their inheritance and fulfill what God had told them to do. We read in Judges 1, it says, the Amorites pressed the people of Dan back into the hill country, for they did not allow them to come down to the plain. So they're stuck in the hill country. They can't really do any farming. They're up in the mountains. They want to be down in the plain where they can get some agriculture going, raise some cattle, some sheep. But they can't do that because the Amorites are holding them back. Now, God said, take possession of the land. Drive out the people. They're failing to do what they're supposed to do. And so instead of actually doing what they're supposed to do and figuring out a way, and it probably means increased devotion and a little more focus on God and dependence on God, instead of doing what they're supposed to do, they said, hey, how about we go find an easy target? Forget about this inheritance that we've got. Let's just go find a place. And so they wander around, they find this sitting duck out there, Laish. And they go there, they take it over, and then for whatever reason, they also decided to build a pagan cult out of Micah's household gods there. They were not doing what they're supposed to be doing, and they just went further into godlessness. So what do we learn from this? What do we learn? Well, I think from Micah, what we learn is that sinning makes it easier to sin more. Micah was sinning. He was not doing what he's supposed to be doing. Particularly, he was not being obedient to God. He was not living the way he was supposed to live. He was not, as we would say as Christians, he was not, you know, trying to live up to Christ's likenessness. But for them, it's just, he's got the law, and he wasn't fulfilling the law. He broke 20% of the law in this one action. He didn't really seem to be all that bent out of shape about it. And his sinning just made it easier for him to sin more. I mean, we've been there, right? You kind of get out of step with God, and you say, I'm going to push it a little bit. I'm going to kind of bend this here, and then it becomes easier to bend it there and break it here, and it's just kind of a downward spiral. And that's what we see with Micah. He got out of step with God. He wasn't living the life that he was supposed to be living, honoring God, obeying his law. And then he just went all the way to the bottom. I mean, you really can't go further to the bottom. You know, stealing, honoring your parents, that's, you know, kind of in the middle of the Ten Commandments, 4, 5, 6 territory. And then he just said, you know what? I'm gonna shoot them all in the foot. I'm going to just go and I'm going to make pagan gods. I'm going to make another god and carve a graven image, right? I'm just going to get rid of the whole Ten Commandments altogether right here. Sinning makes it easier for us to sin more. What about the Levite? Well, the Levite was aimless. That's not good. It's not good to just wander around kind of trying to fulfill our own desires. He kind of interpreted things the wrong way. He saw a prophet. He saw success. And he took that as a sign of God's blessing on his life. He said, I'm a priest. That's my job title, my vocation. I can be a priest to wherever. I'm going to be a priest to the highest bidder. I'm going to be a priest to whoever makes me look the best. And he was happy. He went in. I mean, it's exactly what it says. It says, and the priest's heart was glad. That's what it says when he became a priest over these pagan images for the tribe of Dan. And the priest's heart was glad. He's gone. You know, he's way out there. But he's glad because he's a priest to a whole tribe. It's not just this little house and this kind of household gods. He's a priest to a tribe of Israel. Never mind the fact that it's not a priest of Yahweh. It's a priest of this 5-pound metal image that Micah's mom had made for him. Kind of sounds pretty dainty when you put it that way. But he was glad because he took this prophet and the success and interpret that as fulfillment. That's what he was supposed to be doing. He lost sight of what God had for him to do. And he sought worldly attainment. Money, status, power. He wanted people to go, oh, there's Jonathan. It's not enough that he's from the house of Moses, that he's a descendant of Moses, but he's a priest of that whole tribe. He must be amazing. And what about the tribe of Dan? Well, I think from the tribe of Dan, what we learn is that comfort, ease, availability, frustration, exhaustion, disability, whatever it is that's kind of in our way, whatever it is that's holding us back, that makes us want to give in, there's no excuse for not following God's commandments and God's will for our lives. The Danites had a job. Here's your inheritance. Drive the people out of the land. Take the land for possession. That's your job. They couldn't do it, and they got frustrated, and they couldn't farm and have enough food for their people and enough room for their people. And so instead of figuring out a way to do what they were called to do, what all the other tribes had managed to do for the most part, they couldn't do it, and they said, you know what? Let's just cash it in. Let's go somewhere else. I don't care if this is where God told us to go. Let's just go find somewhere that we can be, where we can find success, where we can have a place, happiness, comfort, ease, whatever it is that they were looking for. They knew God's will, but they abandoned God's will because God's will was hard. It was hard to complete God's will in their lives. Right? I mean, we have to watch out for this. You know, we have to watch out for this in our own lives individually. I think we have to watch out for this, you know, in the life of the church. It can be hard. And we're getting in this place right now where we're talking about changes and growing and doing different things, and that's hard. I heard a report that Brother Craiglow went out to try and help this week, and it was just tough, the heat, you know, but he was there. He was doing it. And we've got to be doing whatever we can do, because we've been called to fulfill a mission. God's given us his will. We know what we're supposed to be doing. And we've got to do it. And no matter what stands in our way, we've got to do it. And we can't be afraid to do it. Right? Fear sometimes makes us afraid to do things. You think they were afraid? The Danites, they were probably afraid. They're sitting there and said, well, the Amorites, they keep driving us back. We could go out there again, but they're probably just going to drive us back. We're going to die. They were afraid. And they said, how about we go find some people who can't help themselves? And let's just kind of take over their land. God has given us a thing to do. We've got to do it no matter how hard it is. Because we know, like the Danites should have known, God will be there. He'll provide. He'll bless. He's not going anywhere. So what's the solution? How do we avoid this? The road to godlessness is paved with godlessness. How do we avoid this? Well, first of all, we must always return to the basics. We must realize that we're sinners in need of a Savior. We must realize that you never outgrow a need for the gospel. 1 Corinthians 2, Paul says this. He says, and I, when I came to you, brothers, did not come proclaiming to you the testimony of God with lofty speech or wisdom. For I decided to know nothing among you except Jesus Christ and him crucified. He says, I didn't come here with this fancy rhetoric. I wasn't, you know, silver-tongued, just winning people over with my words. I just came and I just gave you the bare bones, the basics. Jesus Christ and him crucified. Because it's enough. And it's what we need. And it's what we continue to need. And sometimes we get to this point where maybe we think we don't need it because we know that. You know, sometimes it's hard when you're up here as a preacher and you look out and you're like, I think everybody out there is saved. I don't want to give a gospel presentation because I don't want to offend them. I don't want them to think that I think they're a pagan. But the reality is we need the gospel. And even if everybody in the room were saved, we need to have the gospel because the gospel is the power of salvation. And it's what we got to return to, and it's the basics. We can never get away from that. And if we're going to be a successful church, if we're going to be successful individuals, the gospel has to be front and center, always. Other points of theology ultimately just don't really matter all that much. I mean, they do, but not as much as the gospel. End times, they don't matter that much, right? Other things that we put out there, if we get the gospel right, we can fix the other stuff along the way. But we've got to have the firm foundation. It's got to be there all the time. And if it gets a crack in it, if it gets a leak in it, we got to go back and we got to fix it and shore it up and make sure that it's sound. Or else the house will crumble. We must also remember the basics of what we've been called to do. Discipleship and evangelism. Those are hard. Discipleship and evangelism are hard. I couldn't tell you the amount of times that I've seen people who are missionaries, who are great at evangelism, and they're terrible at discipleship. You know why? Because discipleship's hard. Because that means you actually have to get people to keep coming back. Right? Evangelism, you just got to get them one time and get them to raise their hand or sign a card or say something. It's evangelism. Discipleship means they got to come back week by week for a Bible study or to meet with me one-on-one. And I got to actually dig into their life and see all the, you know, awful stuff that they're doing and tell them to stop it and then make sure they stop it and help them grow into a better person. As a church, sometimes we go the other direction. And evangelism's hard. Discipleship's easy because we're all here. We're all in agreement. Let's just break out a book and start reading it. And let's illustrate some points, and let's tell a story, and let's encourage one another. Evangelism's hard because that means getting doors slammed in your face. It means offending people. It means getting rejected. That means being afraid that you don't know the right things to say and that you're going to mess something up. We got to have the basics, discipleship and evangelism. For our church to be successful, we've got to have discipleship and evangelism. That's why we're going out and pounding the pavement and just saying, hey, how are you doing? Sorry to interrupt you. We're from the church down the street. We get some prayer requests. I'd love to invite you to church. Do you know Jesus Christ? Can I talk with you? That's why we're getting together here for services on Sunday morning, Sunday evening. That's why we have a discussion on Wednesday afternoon or evening. Because discipleship is important. Because we've got to grow in the Word. Teach them all that I've commanded you. It doesn't happen in a night. It doesn't happen in a lifetime. So we got to be about doing that. We have to keep those things forefront. Other things can be extraneous. You know, we do things, things are out there, they exist because they're helpful, they're useful, but they all have to be serving the mission. The mission is evangelism and discipleship. And if we're just doing something for the heck of it, we need to think, you know, is that the way that our energy should be used? If we're not doing evangelism and discipleship as well as we should be, what else do we need to be doing? We don't need to be taking energy and time away from those things. And we must have accountability and encouragement and correction. Judges 17:6 says, in those days there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. And the reality is, and sometimes we lose this in that statement, the kings didn't help. I was talking with Jen earlier, the commentator that I've been reading. He says, you know, a lot of people read this as kind of a pro-monarchy statement, saying when the king gets there, he's going to fix stuff, right? We see that. That's kind of what the whole political season's about, isn't it? Right? They say, when we get the king, they're going to make Israel great again, right? But that's not really what this author is saying. The author is saying, listen, the kings and 1 Kings and 2 Kings, they're the ones that caused the exile. When the kingdom split, so many kings were useless. They led the people into pagan worship. Solomon himself led the people into pagan worship. But what he's saying here in the book of Judges, he's like, you don't need a king. In those days there were no kings, and the people still failed terribly. Right? Why? Because everyone did what was right in his own eyes. Whereas we're called to accountability, for encouragement, and for correction. Book of Hebrews 10:24-25, we know this one. Let us consider how to stir up one another to love and good works, not neglecting to meet together as the habit of some, but encouraging one another, and all the more as you see the day drawing near. And then 12 verses 1 through 2 in the book of Hebrews. Therefore, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us also lay aside every weight and sin which clings so closely, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, looking to Jesus, the founder and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is seated at the right hand of the throne of God. We're surrounded by a great cloud of witnesses, and those cloud of witnesses are saying, keep running, keep going, stop that. Sometimes that's what they're saying, stop that. Sometimes that's what we need to be saying to each other, stop that. Stop being so aimless. Stop being afraid. Stop sinning. And run. And go the way that you're supposed to be going. And let's do it together. So that we can get there together, where we're supposed to be, at the end, with Jesus. That's what we got to do. The road to godlessness is paved with godlessness. We got to nip it in the butt, return to basics, Encourage one another. Hold one another accountable. Keep our eye on the mission that's in front of us. Like I said, it begins with the gospel. If we don't know the gospel, if we're not rooted firmly in the gospel, and if we're not reminded continually of the gospel, we can be like Micah. You know, Micah, he said, one God's as good as any other God. Now I've got this nice shiny God. I like shiny God better than Yahweh. Yahweh calls me to do hard things. Shiny God just sits there, and he's shiny. Sometimes that's the God we want. We just want the shiny God, but the shiny God doesn't make anything better. That's what that passage we read from Isaiah says. What does an idol profit anybody? It can't do anything. You made it. You made it. How's it going to help you? But when we turn to God, the one who made us, and most importantly, the one who made Christ, come to be on this earth and to live and to die in our place to forgive us of our sins. And that's what we need. We need salvation. We need to have this paved with godlessness. We need it cut off. We need to turn and return to God. Trust in Him. Trust in the blood shed for our sins to get rid of the wrath of God, to restore us to a right relationship with Him. That's what we need. That's what we need to remember. That's what we need to call other people to on a daily basis. Pray with me.